This is 1360 AM WNJC, Washington Township, Philadelphia's Renaissance radio station. Brought to you by Forsyth Broadcasting. Listen online at 1360radio.com.
Good evening and welcome to Practice Preparedness with your host, Will Hemingway, coming to you live every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. on WNJC 1360. You can also live stream it. Go to our website at practicepreparedness.com. You can click on the listen live, listen to the show live button and go over and either stream it using an app off of your smartphone or off of your computer. It's the quickest and easiest way to get us and the most reliable no matter where you are around the world. If you missed part of the show or if you missed one of the ones previous to this one, feel free to go to the show notes section and you can listen to all of the previous shows in archive, straight streamed from the website at practicepreparedness.com. So let's see where to start. Today's been quite an interesting day for me. Actually, the past few days have been quite an interesting few days. I had the unusual opportunity to grab onto a moment in time that I hadn't expected to take a quick jaunt down into Maryland, right on the tippy tip of Virginia, Maryland, and near Washington, D.C., for Saturday for the prep. Maryland Prepper Convention. Now, those of you who listen to me know I am not a prepper. Again, we will repeat, I am not a prepper. I am a survivalist and a preparedness trainer. This is what I do. But because people have taken on the moniker of prepper when they don't even actually understand the significance between them, and because prepping is part of what being a survivalist is about, I was interested to go see what they were doing and get a look-see and listen to some of the speakers who were coming on during the show that day and get a handle. And I came away with some very interesting things. Next week, we will be bringing on G.L. Skye, who is an author publisher who is a geospatial specialist and is quite a bright guy. He has a heavy Army background, good military background, along with a private sector background, and can bring us some very interesting insights into many things, not the least of which will be what we're going to talk about, among other things, about his interest in seismology and in seismic activities, earthquakes, and other things along that line. He has spent the last 16 years gathering seismic data so that he could analyze it and look at the long-term trends. So that should be very interesting next week when we have him come on. And in the following week, we'll be bringing on David Jones, who is a nuclear chemical and biological specialist who had worked 25 years as a trainer in that for the U.S. Army, going around the world training personnel on how to handle nuclear, biological, and radiological problems. In this case, we will be talking about some of his expertise in that area, along with the CMEs and EMPs, because he gets into that pretty heavily. So there are two upcoming shows. They should be fun. Gather some information, get to have a little chit-chat with some other people who you may never have come across otherwise. Both of them have books, and Dave Jones has some really great CDs and DVDs of his presentations that I actually picked up a set of, so we'll offer them off of the site too, and we'll see where that goes. We'll have some fun with that. So one of the things that I picked up while I was at the show, I am constantly blown away by how, let's say, we'll use the term, how people, you can have 10 people in the room, and 10 people will hear the same thing, see the same thing, and have 10 different versions of it. As an investigator and an interrogator, I used to get blown away when I would go to an incident, an armed robbery, a bank robbery, and I'd go to interview, and there'd be sometimes over 100 witnesses, all in a clearly lit building, where they all had clear line of sight to the perpetrator or the incident, whatever it was, and not a one of them would even have hardly any matching details in their entire story, some of which would last 20 minutes in their description. It was stunning. This is because the way that the human mind works is that it locks in on things that it is attuned to. So if your mind is attuned to dogs, you like dogs, and they had a dog in the room, there could have been a guy with his hair on fire in front of it, but you will see the dog. There are some actually humorous those silly little photos that they pass around on Facebook. I guess they call them poster blocks or poster photos. And I saw one again. I've seen it a couple times over the ages. And it has a picture of a guy being hit by a car. But it's in the background. And in front of it is a girl with some skin-tight pants on. And you only see basically her torso, her butt, and whatnot in the shot. And they say, it flashes, it's a GIF, so it flashes on and then off and black on and off to words and then that, and it says, did you see the guy with getting hit by the car? And 99% of people who saw it didn't even notice the guy because they were drawn by something that took their attention. 99% of males would not have seen anything but the female figure in front. This is just the way the mind works. And it happens the same way with lots of other things, bright colors and all kinds of other highly distracting images that will draw you away. What I'm amazed by, though, is that in this case, it exemplified one of my target points on something that I want to get across to everyone who listens to my shows. And that is simply this. Last night, a very close friend of mine who went to one of my classes gave me this idea. He said to me that when I project my message, that I am giving them a lightweight version of the word he used actually just exited my brain, unfortunately. He was implying that I telling you that there's something drastic that's going to happen, like in a warning, almost prophetically, that it's threatening to you. But I do it in a way where I'm not saying to you, and by the way, the world is going to end, so quick, buy this now to save yourself. And what's really happening is that what I'm trying to get across, I was happy actually the way he told me, since I just brain farted and can't remember the word he used, but the message that he was giving me was that I actually succeeded at doing what I wanted to. There are lots of things around us that pose lots of serious threats every day. All kinds of things. Bad drivers, fire, wildfire, earthquakes, from extreme to minimally almost insignificant incidents that will still change the course of your life for you. Like backing out of a parking spot in a parking lot at Walmart and striking a pedestrian, right or wrong, your life has changed forever. If you have $15,000 of liability on your car, your life is over if they go to the hospital and get $1 million against you in a judgment. Everything you earn for the rest of at least the next 30 years will go to them, not you. This is a life-changing event. The thing about it is, this is not about saying, by the way, you're doomed, life is over. It's about saying, think about these things, those little things you do, like back into the parking spot, so that when you pull out, you're not going to run over some moron who sees you backing out but decides it's their right to walk behind you anyhow, and you have to see them, so you don't hit them. You have an ability to alter that trajectory based upon many occasions, very small things that you decide to do. So, small things you decide to do. Having enough water in your home put away, rotating it all the time so that if something happened to interrupt the flow of clean water to you via your tap, you have enough to last 3 days, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months, 3 months, at least, so that you can at least stretch it out and get over the bumps so that you don't have a problem. And these are things you can do to change the trajectory for you. And as a result, you can do the same things in other areas. So here I am standing at a booth, and I'm standing at a booth listening to the guy whose booth it was talk about his expertise and his pitch. And a woman comes up and starts talking to him and uses these terms. Well, you know, my husband, he's crazy about this. He's so scared about this happening that if we had the money, he was talking about selling my car so that we'd go down to one car so we could take that money to pay to get a thing put in the ground in the backyard and make a bunker out of it. First point, fear does not solve any problem. Fear blinds you. Fear helps you to make bad decisions. Fear is a bad decision. As I walked around in this show, I was amazed by the fact, and appalled equally, that many of the vendors there were basing their pitch not on, here, buy this water filter because it's really top-notch, and when you go camping, you can use it, and when you go hiking, you can use it, and if anything happens to screw up your water quality at your home, well, they're fixing that. You can use it at home. It's a great deal. No, no. They're selling on, well, when Tetewaki comes, and for those of you who don't know, God help me if you're listening to this show, if you've ever listened and you don't know what Tetewaki is, that is the end of the world as we know it. And if they are saying this to you and saying, you need this because this will make you survive, I will return and say, tell me what it does for me when nothing is happening wrong. Tell me how it will serve me between now and the time that that thing you're talking about, which is probably never going to happen, happens. When I'm having a problem paying for my gas, my electric, my cable bill, my this, my that, the average person, everyone's struggling with this every day. And you're telling me to give you $350, $400 of my hard-earned money for that so I can plop it in the closet or put it on my counter but not really use it? Tell me what it does. These are the questions you should be asking as you are approached by people, when you are inundated, if you're a prepper or a survivalist or into preparedness, when you get these 8 million silly emails like I get every day from all these different things. Survival life. If you want to survive, you need this today. And you open it up and you go through this big deal, silly 5-page long inundation of supposed facts, and they tell you to buy this flashlight that's got a Cree lamp in it that has 2,000 lumens so you can blind your attacker. You don't need a gun. Use this flashlight because you'll stun them. And you can find that same flashlight for $7 on geek.com. And they're selling it for $39.99. But if you try to leave and say, okay, I'll stay and come back, then it goes to like $27.95. Woo, great deal. Here's the thing. You have to be in charge of your own world and how you determine what you're going to do. Will's rule in survivalism and preparedness is simply this. What's between your ears is way more important than what's in your pocket and what's in your bag. If you have the skills and the mindset, you will survive even if you don't have the implements to do it with, because you will find them or make them. This is what happens. If you have not built a mindset, I will argue with anyone who wishes to come to the table with that argument. You and I will go rounds courteously, and I guarantee you, you will lose that argument. Because here's the thing. If you are not prepared to survive, you will not survive in your mind. I tell this story on a regular basis in my classes about a guy who had been stuck after an earthquake. He was stuck in a building, and he had all the free movement in the world. He didn't have a crush injury. He didn't have any issues, no physical injuries. He was trapped inside of a very large basement of a building. There were food stores there where they stored the supplies for the little cafe there. And primarily the edible food that had any protein in it were about 150 large jars of peanut butter and some crackers. So in the first 2 days, he ate the peanut butter and the crackers. He didn't have any water, and he didn't know what to do to get himself water. And so he made it about 3 days, and then he could not put the crackers and the peanut butter to his mouth, because he said later, after he recovered, when he was rescued, that he just didn't want to go on, because if he had to eat peanut butter one more time, he was going to die. So he decided to die. So when they found him 7 days in, and he was dehydrated and malnutrition, laying on the floor in a pool of his own output, he barely had life signs. He had enough food to sustain him for probably a year. Was it gourmet? No. Would he have not died? Absolutely. He had no mental fortitude to get past it. This wasn't because he didn't have food. He decided to not eat and become weak and then become disabled, because it makes you lose your ability to make rational thought. He hurt himself trying to break out, because after he was really hungry, he started having irrational thought processes, bashed himself on a metal door until he knocked himself out at one point, and there he laid waiting to be rescued. This is the reality of the psyche of survival. And the psyche of survival is so critical to the overall plan. So I'm standing at this booth, and this woman goes through this whole thing about the bunker and buying a bunker and so forth and so on. And the guy whose booth it was just head nodding and going, probably in the back of his mind going, step back very quietly, see how far you can get away from him. This one is a little off. We're fine. And go back, and then she drops the ultimate bomb. And I said to my husband, if that's the case and it's going to be that bad, why do I want to live anyhow? If I don't have, and then she reeled off, I forget what she was talking about, satellite dish and this and that and the internet, then why would she want to live anyway? Wow, really? Okay. Like, what? But believe it or not, if you were to actually have a detailed conversation of probably less than 2 minutes with half of the people you know about this thing in survivalism, I'd be willing to bet you that a third of them would tell you that they'd honestly have a hard time coming up with a reason why they would want to go through the trouble to survive if that was all it was going to be. This is normally the words they use. If that's all it's going to be afterwards, what is there to live for? I don't know. I guess there's not for you. So this is the point. The psyche of survival, or like I like to say normally, the will to survive. Do you honestly have the will to survive? Because if you are calling yourself or looking at yourself as a prepper or into preparedness, and you have never looked at yourself and queried yourself seriously, I mean, seriously, sit down one day and say to yourself, if I'm someone else and I'm asking these questions, what are the answers I have? Well, why do you want to do that? What do you mean, why do I want to do that? Why do you want to be prepared to survive? If there's an EMP and the power goes down, the grid goes down from Boston to DC, and 90 million people die in 3 months, and you have to climb over bodies and stack them up and burn them so that they don't contaminate the water and the ground around you and get you sick from cholera and make you die, why would you want to survive in that environment? I don't know, because I want to survive. I don't have to have an answer to that that's really functionally more fancy than because I want to survive. This is what I want to do. There are a lot of people who are hard-pressed to give you an answer that they honestly believe is enough of a reason for them to do that. To me, I find this completely mind-blowing. But in actuality, you will find that this is the case with more people than you would believe. And having worked in the EMS, the fire rescue side, and the law enforcement, private investigative side, I am stunned how many people in the industry also have never sat down and taken stock in themselves as to how they look at it and what motivates them to survive. You've heard the stories over the years, people who were in box canyons in Utah and it was flooding and they were going to die and their arm was crushed or something under a big boulder, and they made the decision to take out their pocket knife and slowly cut their hand off so they could get off, or cut off their lower arm so they could tourniquet and get away and live but have cut their arm off. And the number of people who would have that level of unbelievable tenacity to wish to live are probably not that high. Most people do not have that level of will to survive. 150 years ago, pretty much everyone who came here who wasn't in the city, which I believe is part of the issue, had that tenacity and will to live. It's how they survived all of these horrendous, difficult things that they experienced on the homesteads out in the West and in the Midwest as they spread across the nation, populating new sections of the country and territories. This has left our psyche. And if you don't have it, then you need to either work on it right now or don't waste your time preparing, because there's nothing to prepare for, because if you survive, you're not going to survive anyhow. Take stock in what makes you wish to be here. Take stock in what makes you want to wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night. I have done it many a time, and I'll tell you, there have been some major challenges in my life, some as a result of stupid things or bad decisions that I made, and other ones because I stupidly made bad decisions to go in and try to help someone else and screwed things up for myself. It is the way it is. We are, unfortunately, if you do things, you're going to make mistakes. It's just the way it works. Some of them are only mistakes because they create more headaches. They're not mistakes because we did them. I don't think I've ever regretted having tried to help anyone. I've almost never come up Eve on it, except once in my entire life. All that said and done, in the end, the question is, if you run into these challenges, do you not want to wake up in the morning? I've had those days. I certainly have. I've even had a few of those days recently. But then you have to step back and say to yourself, okay, hold the phone a second. What is it that's so real, that's so disastrous, that makes you get to that point? And this is something that is a lesson that I've learned from dealing with people both on the bad and the good side of the investigative and the protective world. And that is this. When I have high blood pressure, and I do, my blood pressure goes up not because someone came and pumped a pump, and made my pressure go up, not because they hung me upside down so that my face turned red and my blood pressure went up. My blood pressure goes up because my mental attitude, my perspective says that this is something that upsets me or threatens me so much that it makes me compress everything in my body. And when it does that, that compression of my body, my musculature, when you get tense, if you've ever had someone come up and put their hand on your shoulder and go, oh my God, you're really tense. What's that about? Well, how do they know that? Because your muscles are all pulled tight. When that happens, it constricts all your arteries. It constricts all your blood flow. In interrogative interviewing side, we refer to it as the fight or flight syndrome. When you are at fear, when you're highly threatened, when you perceive that your life is at risk or you're being threatened, all of the blood is dumped out of your abdominal cavity, where about 80% of your blood remains on the general average, because it's there to transport your nutrients from the food you eat out of your stomach, the oxygen out of your lungs and around to your body to feed and fuel your body's function. And the capillaries restrict, and it forces the blood out to your extremities in order to give a burst of energy to you, so that it's either flight, which means you're going to run away, or flight, or the fight side, where you're going to actually get down and dirty and run it out. Either way, your body does this as a reactive in order to feed the rest of your body blood. What I learned years ago in physiology classes. Oh, Eddie's dying over here on us. So in between, just so you know, we have Eddie over here who is attempting to break the speed record in typing. He has this little yellow pamphlet, probably from school, and he is rapidly wailing his way through typing God knows what onto the computer, and you can hear clickety clickety. So if you hear this in the background, it is not me. I take no responsible.
They won't. Microphone is off. You are good.
And he's in mess. click, ripping his way through this all the while, and then an occasional
no more, promise, no more.
So we're gonna I refuse to give you the Heimlich maneuver. Sorry, this is I don't have my mouth guard, so you know,
I think I'm almost there.
I lost it, you know. I'll still give you the chest compressions, you know, all good, no problem. So the problem is, though, that, and of course, because I said it, he's going to cough more because it's a subconscious thing. This is what happens. And he's not helping himself anyway, by the way, because he's drinking a Coke that has caffeine in it that dries out your throat so that it'll make you cough more. A little momentary segue. But here's the thing. When you realize that all stress that you have, by the way, this does not negate the fact that you could really have a threat at you and that's threatening you that is causing this physiology to occur within your body. And it's healthy for you to have fight or flight syndrome because it helps your body react so you can move rapidly in whichever form that you intend to do when you make up your mind. But I'll tell you what I did learn in physiology class as an interrogative interviewer, and that's this. For 30 seconds up to 3 minutes, depending upon how shocking the incident is that poses the threat to a person, it almost totally shortens or drains the blood from the person's brain. You know what the significance of that is? It means that you have just become a dog, basically. So what are you going to do? Bite them or run away? That's what happens. Or bark. Humans look silly when they bark, and they really don't do too well when they bite because their incisors aren't pointy enough. So it's kind of not a worthwhile response, but this is where the brain goes. This is why you will see people hesitate when they have one of those moments. There's an awesome little piece in one of my favorite movies, Snatch. And when there's an incident, if any of you have seen it, there's an incident in the movie where they come out of a back door, out of a fight, and they're about to be shot because they were trying, someone was trying to fix a fight and they didn't do what they were told and so forth and so on. But anyway, what ends up happening is, this is the line out of the movie, and I have to bleep the parts out that, you know, but it says, have you ever crossed a road and looked the wrong way? A car's nearly on you? So what do? Something very silly. You freeze. Your life doesn't flash before you because you're too scared to think. You just freeze and pull a stupid face. See, this is real. This is what happens. And in that moment, you can lose everything. This is why we try to prepare, so that those things that are the likely things that you're going to encounter that will threaten you, you will already have it in your mind what the answers are. You don't have to stand there and go, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. Your brain's going, yep, I've thought about this 4 million times. I know exactly what to do. And this is why we practice. This is why the military practices and does exercise. This is why EMS and fire do drills, and why they practice with their fire trucks and they cut cars up and they do this and that, so that when they actually have to do it in an emergency situation where time is of the essence and getting it right is critical, they have muscle memory. Their mind and their body are directly interacting with each other, and they don't have to think about it because it just happens. This is the target that you should have for everything that you do in life that is important. And if you start to act that way, this is not something you're going to do overnight. But if you walk away from having listened to my show today and you start looking at the things that you encounter every day and you peel one of those things off and spend some time thinking about what makes it actually better, the outcome be better. These are repetitive problems you encounter every day. Maybe it's a drive to work and you hit the same traffic, or maybe it's a problem with your car, or maybe it's a problem where you show up to work and you realize you forgot something. And then instead of doing it again and again and again, or repetitively over a period of time, you say, gee, how can I get around this? I know. I'll stick a few extras of those in a little bag in the back seat. So when I get there and I've screwed up, I can go, you know what? Hang on a second. I'll go out to the car and I've got an extra one. If you spill on yourself when you're in the office every day at lunch and you have a spare shirt in the car, you may have a lot more laundry to do, but you don't have a stressful day. And by not having stress, it allows you to be more productive, and it's a win-win-win. This same type of behavior works in survivalism, in real disasters and real problems. When this woman said very vehemently, I don't want to live. I had a very close friend of mine about a year ago say to me, it really shocked me, that if it got bad enough that she actually had to use a generator to have electricity for more than a week, if she couldn't have her car because there was no gasoline to drive, she just wants a pill that she could take and go to sleep and never wake up. And this speaks to the value that people put on their own life. Is the value that you put things on in your life those things that have name badges, or is the value that you put on it the interaction and the quality of the people that you interact with, your experiences, the things you look forward to every day? I looked at them a little while ago and said to myself, my God, what is wrong with me? I've lost my desire to do it. I've had a lot of challenges with my business. I had had a health problem where I had an internal bleed that almost killed me 3 times. It stopped me from doing things that I did every day for 50 years. And suddenly it changed the way I live my life. It is not a happy thing. And it will destroy your psyche as to what you do. And the reason that it does is because and has been very well outlined, by the way, by William James, who is basically known as the father of American psychology. And when William James, who lived from 1842 to 1910, he grappled with the human psyche and its propensities in relation to life, survival, religion, and life after death. And he wrote a book, a very big book, that is called How Habit Defines Human Actions and Survival in Principles of Psychology. Most people who have taken a psych class or two or ten in college have referred to it, the book, as Principles of Psychology. And in Chapter 4, which if you go to my website, I believe I put the link up already. If not, you can go to my section on survival philosophy, and one of the buttons there is for William James's Habit and the Human Condition. And in it, he tells, among other stories, he tells a really intriguing story about how in Chapter 4, he talks about how this train that I believe was Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, and it had an accident in the Midwest. And what happened was the cars crashed, shattered as they crashed into each other when the train derailed, and all these wild animals that were part of the circus were released into the wild, and they were roaming about. And the most remarkable part of it was the recountation of the people who survived the train wreck, who said that the lion got out of its cage when it broke, walked down, walked around, climbed back up, went up, and laid down in his cage. This lion had been taken from freedom in the jungle as a wild hunter and had been turned into a habitual sitter in a small cage who had very little freedom. So what's the point of this? The point is that it had habit trained into it from its environment, like you do. What is your habit in the morning? Do you get up? Do you have a cup of tea? Do you have a cup of coffee? Do you read the paper, or do you read the internet? Do you read a news stream? Do you turn on the TV and watch the news as you're getting ready? Do you have a radio in the shower and you listen to one of the music stations and hear the news on there as you're getting ready? You're doing your bathroom ritual in the morning before you leave for work. If you work from home, do you get up and do similar things? These behaviors become habit, and they create for you a situational behavior set that make you comfortable. By the way, they don't all have to be things you like, but they're things that you do so regularly that when you don't do them, your mind is thrown off because it makes you feel uneasy. It makes you feel like something is missing, and that something missing is a problem, because what it does to you is it will make you uncertain. It will make you lose your drive. So when they interview and when they study victims of natural disasters like major earthquakes, major tornadoes, floods, hurricanes, things like Katrina and Sandy, one of the things that the specialists now that exist now have been trained and taught about is the fact that those who survived and thrived after and immediately after these incidents were people who returned to habitual behaviors that made them feel a level of comfort. The U.S. military refers to it as snivelware. The snivelware thing is something that will save you because it gives you something other than, here's my gun, here's my pack, here's what I have to do. It says, oh, I have that little thing that makes me happy, a little music box. You probably heard stories about people in World War I and World War II. They'd have photos of their girlfriend in their hat. when they felt lonely, when they felt like they were losing their desire to live, when they had been shot and they were laying in the wreckage of a plane on the enemy lines, over enemy lines, the way they stayed alive by their accounts were by looking at those photos of their children or their family who made them want to see them again. These things can be as simple as waking up in the morning, making a cup of coffee, and reading the news, or looking at the news, or whatever it is that you're used to doing. So when you know that, if you create a scenario for yourself now where you can build a habit set that's healthy for you, and in turn, you build a means whereby if everything that you know right now went away, you could still have that little bit of habit and normalcy, you will help yourself increase your survival quotient by tenfold. So for me, the way that works out is every one of my kits, whether it's my short haul kit, my day hike kit, because the point of having the day hike kit is if I fall or I get hurt or I get stuck somewhere or the weather comes in and I get stuck, I have enough that I can survive for 2 or 3 or 4 days on my own until I either rescue myself or they rescue me. This is what happens. Excuse me. And so what do you do? The way you do this is by saying, let's look and take a little survey, take a little assessment of what my habits that are my normal are every day. What makes me feel like my day started out normal? My answer to that is a cup of coffee or two. Maybe, I don't know, an energy bar in the morning or an egg or two and some toast. And I listen to business news in the morning. Or I'll turn on YouTube with my Roku on the TV and watch some YouTube from some of the feeds that I trust with some alternative news on it. Whatever that may be, those comprise my base functions. And as a result, I can duplicate them. Why? Because I have a little coffee maker, a little Vietnamese coffee maker, weighs about 8 ounces with 4 packs of coffee, enough to make me 4 sets of coffee with it. And I can fill at least 2 cups, large cups, with each one of those packets so I can share it with someone. And I can make it with 1 bottle of water. And I'm good to go. I have a little single burner stove and the canister for it. It'll last me a week, maybe 2 weeks at that. There's my snivelware. And it guarantees that even when I feel at my worst, like I am not going to survive, when I'm cut off, whichever way it is, from those things that are my norm, that I can build some level of normalcy so I can have a centering point. You can center yourself so that you can bring yourself back. I had studied Tai Chi, however you want to say it, depending on who you are. And one of the things about Tai Chi is that you center on your chi and your center of your body. You bring it together to bring yourself a state of calm, a state of thoughtfulness. And this thoughtfulness and calm helps bring you to a point where you can make intelligent decisions, rational decisions to be able to help and save yourself, whatever the problem is that you encounter. So taking away from this visit down there to the show, a couple of primary points that seem to be the predominant attitude of people who were roaming about, they're purchasing things. The one told me that he had spent over $800 on just one thing for a little solar panel. My question in my mind, which I did not ask him because it would be like throwing salt in their eyes after the fact, was, what are you going to do with that solar panel? How much does it output? What does it require? What kind of a disaster would there be where it would go down, where it would still be working, and what would you be charging with it once you did? My question is, couldn't you have a crank radio that would give you weather, and when there's a disaster, they use a weather station also to get out emergency alerts to people. And you don't need to worry about charging it because you have a crank radio, and you crank it a few hundred times and it'll run for an hour, and you get the interesting news or the information that you need to know what you need to know, and then get on your way. But $800 is out of his bank account for that. What's he going to do with it? God knows. If there's an EMP, which according to a lot of government sources, because I don't know if you've been watching the geomagnetic activity over the past week or two, but we've had some pretty serious activity. Many of them didn't leave the A channel, but, you know, it's just the same. There, when the Carrington event happened in 1859, nobody thought anything was going to happen then either. And blam, it happened, and it wiped out all the telegraph lines across the U.S. When we look at these things, we should be looking at, it's not how much money you spend, it's the choices you make that are going to benefit you the most. So, mobility, cover from bad weather, things like rain suits, things along that line, means to carry the gear. You are never going to be, I have a 79-pound pack, and I have a 39-pound tactical pack, which I'll put on my front. So between them, it's well over 100 pounds. You, the average person, will not be able to make it 13 miles, 15 miles a day, toting that pack like U.S. military personnel are trained in basic training. You will never make it. So then you have to come up with solutions. Do you have a wagon, a garden cart? Can you toss it all in there and tote that? How hard is it to tote that? If you need a rope to wrap around your waist so you don't have to lean over and get a backache walking, then maybe you need to think about that. These are the things you can do to change your perspective and give you a reason to want to live. If you don't want to live, then don't waste your time getting prepared. But I believe most people, when it comes right down to it, after they get past their annoyance at not having the answer, and after they get past their fear that blinds them to answers, they can actually come up with reasons why they want to live. If you can't, I can't help you. Unfortunately, even though I'd like to, I don't have an answer. But for those of you out there who are listening, who have an answer and do want to survive, I would point you to my perspective section of the practicesurvival.com website. Under the perspective side, if you go down them, I hit on most every one of the major topics and perspectives that will help you build a mindset of survival so that you can survive. Until you own these thoughts and these ideas, no matter how much gear and how many toys you have, it won't make a difference. Will not make a difference. Your survival depends first on what is between your ears. And the first part of what's between your ears has to be a clear understanding that if someone asked you tomorrow, you could overwhelm them with the quality and the depth of your answer as to why would you want to survive. This is something that 99% of people have never even considered the question, let alone what their answer is. I task you to do that with yourself and everyone you know. And if you don't have a good answer, consider that as your first goal in survivalism, as finding the answer that works for you, that makes you wish to go through the trouble to survive. Again, no matter how large your wallet is, no matter how big your bank account is, this is not about that. It won't cost you a red-blooded cent. You have to put the time and effort in to think about these things to make sure that you are not, can I say that? Okay, so you don't piss in the wind. This is the thing. You have to know that if you're doing this, you're not just wasting your time. This is not an exercise of futility. So Yesterday I did a class on electronic security, and one of the things that I was making the point about is that if you had a disaster, say you leave, you go to work, you go to school, you come back, your apartment burned to the ground because some Nimrod that lives next door to you left a candle burning or was smoking a joint and dropped it in their sofa or whatever. And the next thing you know, everything you work for, everything you own is gone. The question becomes, again, this is an assessment. Don't wait for it to happen. Do you have insurance? If you're a renter and you live in an apartment, do you have renter's insurance? If you live at your parents' house, we'll start on the low end. You live at your parents' house. Do they have insurance? Does it have riders to cover the things that you own? Or when it happens, when a fire happens or some other massive thing, Marco just texted me and his answer is call Will. Thank you, Marco. If you don't have these things, it's only like $200, $300 a year to get renter's insurance. Even if you live in your parents' house, say you're 20, 25, you're in school, you're still trying to make your way. Imagine the difference if you lose everything you own and it's not covered. Have you taken pictures of the things you own and put them somewhere other than in the place where the fire would happen? Do you have the serial numbers? By the way, you can use your phone and take a picture of every one of the serial numbers. Make sure they're legible afterwards. And upload them to the cloud. Even if your phone burns, you can go to the cloud later on with your new phone, download them, and present them to the insurance company, and voila, you have proof of all the things that you lost. This is what happens. That's the low end. What if you own your own house? Do you have coverage? If you work in an industry, do you have your tools covered? What if you put your tools in your car and your car insurance doesn't cover them? Your life is screwed. These are the simple side of survival. You are in charge of these things. If you choose to abdicate your right to change the trajectory, don't complain when it bites you in the rear end. This is the way it is. You have the ability to take the time. None of these things have to be done all at once. You can start early and start easy. Get yourself a flash drive with the free encryption like SanDisk has on it, or you can buy the upgraded version for like $6 or $7 and start scanning. If you don't have a scanner, get a friend who's got a scanner. You know somebody, you probably know 10 people that have a scanner. You can scan your driver's license, your passport, your birth certificate, your social security card, all the critical key things that you have so that if something happens, they're on the chip, you can pull them right off of there. Put on there what meds you take. Put on there what things you have that you require. If you have allergies, put it on the outside in the non-encrypted section. We covered this last night in the class. So that if anything happens and they find a chip on you, put it, tuck it into your wallet or tape it on something and put a note in bright red that says, if you find me on the ground or I'm unconscious, check my flash chip that's taped to this. It has my medical information, my allergies, and other critical information. That way they can use it to save you. These are critical basic things. Again, you only have to do these if you want to survive. If you have a death wish or you don't want to wake up tomorrow, then I guess I can't help you. But because I think you can, and you will, and you want to, then start working on these. Each day, do something different. Each day, add something to the list that you've completed. And in no time, you will have lots of things in your quiver, lots of arrows in your quiver to be able to save yourself from as you move along. This is the bottom line. So, assess your world. Assess yourself. Ask yourself, why would I want to survive a really catastrophic disaster? And then add this last thing. I have read and also been involved in several incidents of recovery of victims and incidents where the people thought that it was a statewide or a nationwide disaster that hit because they had no radio, no communications, and they were sure that the world had basically come to an end. They stayed right there suffering because they figured there was nowhere to go. It was all that way everywhere. And little did they know, the one instance, till 3 days later, when the clouds cleared, they could see the lights in the distance, and they could tell that the town next door was all lit up and everything was fine. And within a few hours walking, they could have gotten the safety and help. Instead, they suffered for 3 days because they thought that it was hopeless. This is the power of the perception. Perception is reality. Reality is perception. So if you walk away from anything from this show, my mission today in my mind was to get you to understand that you have to actually put in your mind the reasons for your survival and then plot a course to your success. No one else can, because if they try to for you, they will be dragging an anchor and you'll probably make them both die. That's the reality. So when we go off the air in a minute, I will basically leave you with the thought. Actually, we have, what, about 2 minutes left? 2 minutes. So think about the idea that if you want to live and you want to survive, no matter what it is, there's always something better after that. It's a matter of getting there. And you may have the opportunity to create that better for yourself. So think about what it would take for you to be able to create that better and start working on it now. I'm Will Hemingway. This is Practice Preparedness. You can visit us on practicepreparedness.com. If you missed part of the show, you want to go listen to it again, go to the show notes section. You can also check out the seminars section for the last classes that I did and links to all the information about them and our groups and everything else in the training. So until next time, I'm Will Hemingway. Be safe. Be prepared. Remember, there is no disaster when you are prepared. We're out.